Good afternoon on the West Coast, and good evening on the East Coast. You're listening once again to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Today, ladies and gentlemen, is part two of Michael Cottingham's fantastic series of lectures, which occurred on May the 27th, 1998, at our 1998 annual conference. So please get ready for some astounding, fantastic, and informative educational, nutritional, and medicinal, herbal information, and make sure you take plenty of notes.
So we're going to talk about, well, it seems like we have time. Someone asked me about the top 10 herbs, and I mean, it's such a linear thing, but actually it's very, I've decided that I'll compromise a little bit more and more. Instead of elaborating on, you know, symptoms and concepts and such, I think it's a good idea. I think that was a really good suggestion, and I actually have been thinking about it. If I can tell you top 10 herbs and why I think you might want to know these top 10, then that gives you a year-long research project. And gives your focal point, a reference point. I'm really big into, this year, I just come up with concepts or, you know, things so I can relate to my students in a way that, and reference points were always a place to come back to. You know, so there's so much information, you know, with the internet and the books. And if you don't have reference points, if you don't know what you're looking at or what you're researching or why you're researching, if you don't have reference points, you just get lost. You get disinterested. So if I give you the top 10 herbs, then maybe you'll have 10 reference points to look at over the next year and places to come back to if you get sick. You say, oh, that was one of the top 10 herbs. Maybe I'll try it for this. And I think it's a good idea. It'll help you on a practicum. It'll actually be, you know, might help you out more over the year than anything else that I give you. What would make the top 10 herbs? I often think there's like three or four, maybe five factors of what actually dictates an herb to be in the top 10 category. Number one is accessibility. Can you either buy it everywhere in the country? Because what we have here is people from California to New England and everywhere in between. So I have to make a top 10 list different for all of us here today than I would say for people living just in New Mexico. Their top 10 herbs would be, you know, they might be half of your herbs, but they would have five herbs that you would probably never see or know unless you lived in New Mexico. And that makes sense. So accessibility, can you buy it? Can you find it growing within, you know, 100 miles or even in your yard? I mean, within a short distance, can you get the seeds to grow it? Can you find it growing wild or can you purchase it? Accessibility actually is one of the things that make the top 10 herbs in the category. What are the other ones? I have four distinct. Multiple uses. There are so many plants in the world. There are, you know, thousands and thousands of medicinal plants. Some of them, you know, due to my lack of understanding or knowledge, I just view them as they have one distinct use. Maybe they're so toxic that you can't use them for a multiple variety of uses. You can only use them for one distinct thing, and that's good enough. And I'm sure there's more to that, but, you know, there's just so much to learn in so little time. So herbs that make it in the top 10 category, as far as I'm concerned, are herbs that do a variety of different things. So instead of having 10 herbs that only do 10 things, the herbs that make it in this category would do 1,000 things. because each one of those herbs would have the ability to be, you know, to be astringent, to be circulatory, or to be an astringent and to be a nerve herb. But the problems that you could use it with would amount into the hundreds and hundreds of different problems. That's another thing that leads you into the top 10 list. The herb has to have multiple uses, has to be versatile, has to have some, you know, an understanding what that would allow you to apply it from, you know, athlete's foot to colds, chest colds, the same plant, just, you know, changing the application. So you've got multiple uses, you got accessibility, and that could be, you know, picking top 10 herbs that, for my use, or for my idea, if I gave you 10 herbs that were versatile, accessible, and had little to no toxicity, that would be the best. That would be very, you know, I wouldn't have to lay awake at night saying, my God, I forgot to tell them about it. If they do that on a full moon, that herb's going to cause them to break out in a rash. Or, not likely, but, you know, herbs are very forgiving. And if you're paying attention to the mind-body relationship, if they're not appropriate, remember, most herbs are not sneaky, are not accumulative in toxicity, and if they're not right, they're going to tell you within the first few times of use. They're going to give you a headache, they're going to give you diarrhea, they're going to give you a stomach ache, they're going to just kind of, and if you're paying attention, they're going to say, basically, don't be taking me. I'm going to make you vomit every time I make a cup of my tea. Herbs are pretty straightforward, unlike steroidal drugs, which eventually destroy your liver, but, you know, you don't know it until a few years down the road, you know. The accumulative sneaky toxicity of pharmaceuticals are legendary. Herbs are pretty straightforward. Don't underestimate them. Don't ever fall into the concept that herbs are safe and leave it that as a carte blanche type of concept, because that's not true. Herbs cause change, and you take them to cause change in the body, and that change is stimulating natural healing, or, you know, the herbs are doing nothing but encouraging spontaneous or natural healing to take place. And as long as you remember that, they do cause change, and you watch out for obvious side effects. So toxicity. Now, the herbs that I have are pretty, they're like that. And, well, I'm sure there's some other parameters, but the parameters are kind of, you know, hot wind. I think it's important, one of the top 10 herbs should be a circulatory herb. Because remember what I said outside, illness has a lot to do with stagnation. In fact, I can't think of anything. Chest cold, arthritis, gout, cancer, tumors, hives, rashes, poison ivy. The common denominator there is a stagnation. It's a lack. I mean, if you had homeostasis, that meant you would have movement, and that means you wouldn't have the problem. So I can't think of one illness where congestion or a stuck condition isn't part of the illness. And so circulatory herbs are vitally important. They provide movement. They provide movement back towards homeostasis or balance. So, you know, I'll mention this herb, but I'll mention other ones that are circulatory herbs, so we, you know, so it's not like we're spending time. Ginger root tea. Those who have listened to me on the radio, either on Bill's show or my show or last year or just in casual conversation, know I'm a big fan of ginger root tea. Ginger is a vasodilator. Opens the arteries, capillaries, and veins, medium-sized arteries and veins, all capillaries for the most part, except for the various tiny, tiniest ones. Opens them up, dilates. It's a vasodilator. So it moves blood. It moves stagnation. It moves a stuck condition. Ginger root tea, you can use it in chest colds, sinus infections, stomach aches. You know, the list is endless. One of your research projects or your reference points is to know that ginger root tea is in the top 10 and is a great premier, very little to no toxicity. If you drink too much ginger root tea, you may get a headache because you've over-vasodilated. You're sweaty and you're hot because you drink 5 cups of ginger root tea, and now you're sweating and you feel woozy because blood's just flowing like, you know, Niagara Falls through your system. But that's medicinal. If you have a fever, you know, drinking hot cups of ginger tea will, and you get two ways to bring a fever down is either to sweat or to urinate. Most people who get fevers, they're not sweating, and they shut down urination. You know, they shut down their kidneys for the most part. So the herbs, when you want to use herbs for fevers, to bring fevers down, basically you're trying to find herbs that either cause sweating or herbs that cause a diuretic action. And that's how you, you know, get fluids moving again. You know, if you sweat or urinate, you'll be encouraged to drink water, and that will cause circulation and bring the fever down. Now, you may not, ginger root tea, if you live in the tropics or if you live in a very humid area and have a greenhouse, you could probably grow ginger root. But it doesn't, it's a great plant. Right now it's accessible because you can buy it anywhere. It's a marginal accessibility. I don't, you know, if commerce just dissipated, ginger root tea, I'm going to revise it because ginger root tea wouldn't be in the top 10 because unless you lived in Hawaii or Southern California or had greenhouses or hot houses, or you wouldn't have ginger root. It's not very easy to grow in North America unless you have humidity and heat. Florida would be fine. If you lived in Florida, you could grow all the ginger root you wanted. So two other plants that come very close that would be, they're not like in the top 10, but they're next to ginger. They're ginger / yarrow, Y-A-R-R-O-W, and we'll see that plant outside, and oregano, especially the wild oregano, which wild oregano grows from California to Maine, and probably from North Florida on up to Michigan. And you can grow oregano in your garden. Oregano is domesticatable, grows in the house, grows in pots, grows outside. So you have ginger / yarrow / oregano. They occupy the first plant space. They're not three plants in the top 10. There are three possible substitutes depending on where you live. I would prefer to be right now because we have commerce. Ginger root would be in the top 10, would be one of the greatest herbs you could learn about. It's, ginger root tea is a great vehicle for making a hot cup of tea and then adding your extracts to that tea. It's really important if you're like dealing with the immune system or you're dealing with trying to heal the body, is that you have a circulatory herb delivering the other healing herbs. If you have immunostimulants, it's always good to put immunostimulating herbs into circulatory teas so that you get them through the body. You move them through the system. And that will make more sense after I explain it in the immune system aspect here in the next hour or whenever it appears. But yarrow, found throughout the world for the most part. Yarrow, like I said, we'll see it outside, I'll identify it. You won't see it in flower stage, but it'll be, you'll be able to taste it. And most of you will recognize it. Yarrow is a circulatory herb. It's a sweater. It makes you sweat. It makes you move. It makes you push circulation, push your blood through the body. It does much of what ginger does, but it has other aspects. And in fact, yarrow would rival ginger in the top 10, really, when I think about it. Yarrow has the ability of being antibacterial. Yarrow has the ability of not only being circulatory and moving, but it's antibacterial. It's also a bitter, so you can use it as a bitter digestive tonic. It's antifungal, and yarrow is antiviral. So there are other aspects. Ginger has some of those aspects, but yarrow has, they're more distinct in the yarrow. But the unfortunate thing with yarrow is it's horrible tasting for most people. So that's why ginger comes up a little bit again, in public. Because it's that more people will drink ginger root tea for circulation than they will yarrow root tea. And they'll do it more on a regular basis. The other one is oregano. And oregano, because when you crush oregano and you smell it, it has all those aromatic oils and resins and such. Any plant that you crush and smell, or any plant that you smell that is powerful, has aromatherapy oils and resins coming off, will always be vasodilating. That is the nature of essential oils, plain and simple. It's often overlooked. They always list it as a part of what the plant does, but any plant that has powerful aromatic resin type oils will by nature be vasodilating. It's how the body responds to those volatile and essential oils. So oregano, hot cups of oregano tea will make you sweat your brains out. And the plants, once again, is another common denominator thing to allow you to use more plants. Plants that have oils and resins will always be antibacterial and are most likely antiviral. And this is, you know, this makes importance when you're trying to find substitutes and you don't have books on hand. You find a plant in the wild, let's say a plant that you that we haven't talked about, but something that might pop up in your garden somewhere. Mint, peppermint. I haven't really elaborated about peppermint, probably won't in too much depth, as most of us know it. But if you smell peppermint, the oils, the resins, even though I don't mention that it's antibacterial, it will be. It's the nature of oils and essential oils and resins. And because those oils and resins are there, peppermint is a vasodilator. And even though you may read in the book, peppermint, good for stomach aches, and that's all they say, keep in mind that you can go beyond that linear description. And when you smell that plant, you say, hey, it has oils and resins, very fragrant, very aromatic. It's got to be antibacterial. It's got to be vasodilating. I don't have ginger. I don't have yarrow. I bet I can use peppermint for everything that those other plants were used for, and you can. So that's how you start to find substitutes and adapt. And when you start to think like that, then all you need is 25 plants. You don't need a lot of plants. You just need to know concepts about the plants. If you know that essential oils, no matter on what plant they're on, are always vasodilating, that allows you to use plants, all plants that have essential oils, a little bit differently. I'm chasing my tail a little bit over and over, but they're simple concepts, and it's just, you know, they help us. They help us a lot in breaking away from, don't memorize what plants are good for. Try to learn what the plants are about, the intuitive aspect. If you crush the plant, smell it, it's very strong and aromatic, and you've never read anything about it, and even if you don't know its name, you can almost be sure that it's vasodilator, antibacterial, antifungal, just by having essential oils. And you may not never know its name, and may never know what it is, but, you know, I'm not saying use it, because it might be toxic, but, it's a possibility. You could use it if you have some parameters to eliminate it as being a toxic plant. Anyways, ginger, yarrow, oregano, all vasodilators, all stimulate circulation, all have antimicrobial action, all are accessible for the most part. And you need a circulatory herb, plain and simple. Another herb we talked about in the past, and I don't want to raise Bill's temper or anything by elaborating on these same topics again, but nettles, stinging nettles have to be in the top 10, plain and simple. They're next to coca leaf. Remember we were outside talking about high calcium content, vitamins and minerals, and how coca leaf had the greatest amount of vitamins and minerals, you know, it's a food/medicine plant. Nettles comes in almost second place, as far as I know, to this day. I don't know of any plants that actually surpass it. Nettles will stop osteoporosis, nettles will stop anemia, and if you never knew anything else about nettles, that's amazing. If you can stop an anemic condition in one's body with a plant by just drinking a simple tea, that's a powerful mineral and vitamin-rich plant, and that's nettles. Just remember when you go to use nettles, nettles can be found from California to Maine, British Columbia, Alaska, down to South America, you know, almost to Terra del Fuego down in southern Chile. It's found worldwide. The genus is Urtica, U-R-T-I-C-A. You could live off of nettles. Maybe have to catch a little squirrel or eat frogs or some grubs occasionally for a little protein, but there's so many vitamins and minerals in nettles that you could literally live off the plant. And it is a very common plant in the forest. You'll find it growing along streams, in forested areas, along river areas, in the back area, not right necessarily, not sometimes on the riverbank, but mostly it likes quiet, kind of moist, swampy areas. Most of you know stinging nettles, met the plant, got stung, wearing shorts, you know, it's, you can find it easily in books or just walk along. And if you don't know the plant, you can easily find it growing near where you live. And this plant will stop anemia. It's very important for women to know because it can stop osteoporosis. And nettles is really good for the prostate. It's really good for the urinary tract. It's a liquid vitamin. And that's why it's in the top 10, because it rebuilds red blood cells. You could use it in cancer. You could use it in any immune system deficiencies whatsoever, to rebuild the immune system, to rebuild not only the quantity of red blood cells, but the quality, making them stronger, making them actually, and white blood cells, making them stronger, making them able to go out and scavenge waste more effectively. You can make, people don't realize that you can make blood cells white and red, and you can make them wimpy due to your diet and lack of exercise and lack of, well, you can make them weak, or you can make strong blood cells. You can make strong white blood cells and red blood cells that do their jobs distinctly. And herbal medicine really helped to encourage not only the quality of blood cells, but often in many cases, especially when we talk about the antiviral herbs, the quality, not just quantity, but the quality, making white blood cells stronger so that they actually are more aggressive against viruses. They're not just unionized, lackadaisical garbage fighters, viral fighters. They're warriors. They're not detrimental to the body, but they're just strong, distinct, well-formed, and well-programmed in their innate jobs. So nettles, can't do without it. It's a very important find. Great for women who are breastfeeding, women who are pregnant, people who are malnourished, people who are recovering from debilitating illnesses, surgery. Because it is a liquid vitamin, because nature has proportioned it in a way of absorbability, you get calcium, you get iron, you get manganese, you get phosphorus, et cetera, you get all this stuff absorbed. Not just taken and excreted, but you take and drink the plant, and it's best in tea plant, as a tea plant, done as a tea. And or you can take dry nettles and grind them up, put them in soups, stir fries, things of that nature. Now this plant, the next plant, I'm going to elaborate a lot on it because it really is one of the important aspects to the antiviral segment, and it's called red root. It's Ceanothus. Ceanothus is the genus, and that's spelled C-E-A-N-O-T-H-U-S, Ceanothus, and there are many species throughout America. In California, it's called Ceanothus californica, or California lilac. People from California familiar with the California lilac growing along the highways, big purple flowers, very fragrant. That's red root. In New Jersey and New England, it's called New Jersey tea, and red root is called, it's Ceanothus, that's the genus Americana. In the Southwest, we have Ceanothus, Grapei, Emberi, et cetera, et cetera. Any book you can pick that up. I don't need to chase around Latin names too much. Ceanothus is the genus, many different species, all use the same. And red root is one of the most important plants, period, because it electrically recharges cell walls. Specifically, this is a phenomenal key area. This is a PhD. This is a doctorate right here. If you were into research or knew someone wanted research and did their doctorate, this is a major research project. This is a phenomenal plant. This is a plant that is a lifesaver. It does something very few other plants do. Remember I talked about a cell wall, positive, negative charge, or, you know, positive on one side, negative on another. When you get congestion, when you get sick, when you get virally infected or bacterially infected in the lymph glands specifically, you lose one of the charges, one of the positive or negative. You lose the charge on the wall. Thus, you get congestion. And by taking red root, I don't know how it works, but it's, and why it works in this, but one of the active constituents, ceanothin, actually encourages the electrical charge to reestablish itself. So if you have a strong positive charge, a strong negative charge, a cell wall in the middle, and now congestion, viral debris, dead cell structures can move through and be eliminated in the normal waste channels. Now, if you think about that, you could use red root in any situation, cancer, immune system deficiency. I can't do without red root in my formulas. I can't do without red root on serious acute situations, because there is no other herb that I found that is so effective in reestablishing the charge of the cell walls of the lymph glands. And I have a feeling, I don't know for certain, but I have a feeling it does it for other parts of the body as well. But if you can move congestion out of the lymph system, you can keep your immune system from becoming backed up and fatigued. In the 1800s, Redruth was real famous with the eclectic physicians for the ultimate cure for tonsillitis. Tonsils are nothing more than the main line, the first entry lymph system in your body. I mean, they're one of the biggest. I mean, think about the tonsils right there at the mouth, the nasal passage. They're a major organ, a major player in fighting infections and keeping. And remember how they used to just remove them? How many people had their tonsils removed? You know, it's like Redruth could become a great ally if you're not healthy and you find that you always have low-grade infections that are boggy. When you get sick, maybe you get over it because you're still strong and have a strong immune system. But if you find that, you know, you have low-grade infections that linger on and you always feel slightly congested in your lymph glands, especially people that have their tonsils removed, would find Redruth liberating. I mean, for tonsillitis, I mean, so Redruth, I don't know if you can see or get the picture yet of how Redruth could fit into just about any herbal formula whatsoever. From a minor cold, a minor bacterial infection, to a major viral problem. I'll tell you, as we talk about the viruses and such, viruses are very ravaging to the lymph glands. Viruses, I don't know if they like the area or that's just the nature of the body, but viruses do very well by destroying lymphatic movement and sort of hanging out there, causing a breeding ground of food to develop. You know, viruses live off of dead cells and tissue cells, skin cells or tissue cells that just aren't regenerated and are just sloughing off and the garbage of the body. Viruses and bacteria feed off of this stuff and replicate and energize themselves off of your body, and especially off of the garbage and debris that's in the lymph fluid. And so that's a place they probably choose to hang out because it's a very good feeding ground. And so I worry that some of the super viruses, you may have powerful antiviral herbs or powerful antiviral medicines like ozone or UV light. There are other non-herbal approaches that are very powerful, but there's nothing quite like encouraging Redruth, encouraging the lymph system through the use of Redruth to clean and remove all debris from the lymph glands. I mean, I just feel whether they drop viruses on us or not, our lymph system, due to our food, water, air, et cetera, our lymphatic system is overloaded, overtaxed. And if you have problems with environmental illness or environmental sensitivity, or you have problems with chronic fatigue syndrome or HIV, or you have one of the herpes viruses, Redruth plays a role in all of those. Redruth is also really famous for women with fibrocystic breast disease, where you've tried all the medicines, you've tried all the therapies, you've tried cutting back on chocolate and coffee, and you still have the lymphatically congested hardened nodules. It may take a while. The average woman who may have fibrocystic breast disease might want to do 30 drops of Redruth, fresh Redruth extract, 3 or 4 times a day for 3 or 4 months. But it works. It's one of the few things out there. Some dietary changes, cutting back on sugar, caffeine, chocolate, and encouraging lymphatic movement through the use of Redruth, especially Redruth put into ginger root tea, because ginger root tea is very circulatory. Very promising. Ovarian cysts, uterine fibroids. Redruth is very good for people who suffer from hemorrhoids. Varicose veins, lymphatic congestion in the pelvis area, like prostate enlargement, constipation. Here's a sign of somebody who's lymphatically congested, lymphatically impaired, and they may feel swollen, they may feel the lymph system, they may catch up, and when they get an infection, it gets them in the lymph glands, they get swollen, it lingers on for a long time. They may have hemorrhoids, they may have constipation, they may have varicose veins, they have a tendency to feel stuck or plugged. Those are people who you could call lymphatically impaired or lymphatically congested. They have problems like irregular bowel movements. And when they have bowel movements, it's constipated and painful, dry, dehydrated. They have hemorrhoids, they have varicose veins, they have poor circulation in the legs, they have prostate congestion. Red root can affect all of those by improving lymphatic movement. The lymph glands, just a visualization, you know, I'm not an MD with, you know, and can deliver the exact anatomy and physiology of the lymph system, but I'm very good at visualization, and I like to think of the lymph glands throughout the body as little sponges about this big, a couple little sponges in the back of the throat, some under the arms, some in the breast, in the groin, little sponges, little yellow sponges that absorb and release and absorb and release and deal with a lot of waste and lymphatic fluid and do a lot of cleansing. And when they no longer can absorb and they no longer can release, all those little sponges in the body are stuck and filled up, and a whole variety of problems can unfold as a result. So one plant, red root taken, can encourage lymphatic movement everywhere in the body, and that is a revolutionary, you know, aspect that can touch every illness, especially the terminal, hard-to-reach problems. Some people I've worked with have chosen to chemotherapy over alternative medicine or integrative medicine or whatever. Because listen, chemotherapy is easy for some people. I mean, chemo, they're not diligent. They're not going to choose dietary changes, exercises, life. They're not going to quit their job. They're not going to do these teas. They're just not that type of people. And that's okay. So they choose chemo. Now, chemo, of course, is very, it is what it is. May buy you some time, you know, but in the time, it's going to make you terribly, it's going to stress the lymph glands, it's going to stress the liver. And believe it or not, people may choose chemotherapy, but there are herbs that you can use to keep chemo from ravaging the body a lot less, red root being one of them. And we had a friend who actually, her lymphatic cancer was so spread, and I told her, I said, you know, red root has no known toxicity, and it's a wild card. I don't know what it would do in lymphatic cancer. To me, my gut feeling is that it's okay, and that I think it would be a benefit. She chose chemo anyways, and I said, well, that makes my choice easier. We're not going to rely on red root totally. So let's use red root, if you're willing, to keep the chemo focused on the lymph system and keep the chemotherapy from destroying the lymphatic glands, because she was terminal. She had lymphatic cancer nodules throughout the entire system. They had written her off. And she's alive today, and they could not believe she chose chemo. We did two herbs. We did milk thistle for the liver to protect the liver and to keep her digestion going. And we did red root. We did mega amounts of red root because she was doing mega amounts of chemotherapy. And the doctors were just like constantly amazed. It kept clearing out. She kept getting better. And they were just like humoring her with the chemo in reality, because it was just like they told her, you know, what's your 20% chance, 30% chance that this will work? And she's alive well today, I mean, feeling better than ever before. And I've known her constitution, I've known her and worked with her for years and years with her variety of different problems, so I was very familiar with her body, her anatomy and physiology, and especially her overall constitution. I know what she's been taking for many years. But so you may choose allopathic medicine, you may choose something like chemotherapy, but there are, maybe you can integrate. Maybe you want to choose that, but there are some tools like red root and milk thistle that you could actually incorporate with allopathic medicine if that's your choice. Again, I'm trying to keep coming into red root to like really just hammer it. It's an important plant. I'll tell you, here's a scenario. They spray this viruses, put it in the water, put it in the dog food, or, you know, whatever, and people were dying left and right. Red root would be one of the baseline herbs for all my other antivirals that I would use for myself and my family, and for anyone else who was open to it, because it would get those killer antiviral herbs through the lymph system, like clockwork, and would keep the lymphatic system from becoming over-congested. And I think that will be the secret. Lots of, you know, viral activity takes place in lots of water. But don't let the drinking lots of water, but do not let the water accumulate and cause edema and let the lungs fill up. That's a risk, you know, in some of the killer viruses. People die not from the virus per se, but from their lungs filling up, from their lungs shutting down, from pneumonia, you know. And it's, they died from the virus, but the real mechanics of it was they, you know, couldn't breathe anymore. They suffocated or drowned in their own fluids. And I think red root is really good for people who have congestive heart failure, people who actually are quick to retain their fluids. They have swelling in their feet. Their heart isn't pumping. Their kidneys aren't filtering. So their fluids tend to fill up, retain, and they need lymphatic congestion. They need their edema moved out of their body. That's, red is powerful. I mean, it's really, and there's no known toxicity. It's a medium astringent, so maybe if you did it in mega amounts, you know, 100 drops, 3 or 4 times a day, you might get some over astringentizing of the tissue, but for the most part, I've never seen that to happen. And it can form the basis of a majority of your herbal medicine approaches, to, you know, your formula approaches. What other herbs you might think are in the top 10, or what other herbs might you want to see in the top 10? Herbs for
cayenne.
What's that?
Cayenne.
Cayenne under normal conditions absolutely could be in the top 10. It doesn't need accessibility as far as, you know, I mean, right now it does. You can buy cayenne pepper anywhere in America and buy a whole variety of different. It doesn't grow really, it grows fairly well, not extremely well, outside of the arid southwest or arid climates. And cayenne struggles in humidity and climates. And cayenne would kind of run right next to ginger, yarrow, and oregano, and cayenne. It would fall into that circulatory category. So, cayenne, you know, if you like it, if you have it, if you can grow it, it could be in the top 10, and it could be your circulatory herb. And it could also, you know, you can take cayenne and on an open wound, sprinkle it in there, and it's hemostatic, it stops the bleeding. Cayenne actually is extremely antibacterial. It's famous for healing stomach ulcers, even though it seems crazy to use something hot to heal an ulcer. But it stimulates circulation so that it moves stagnation out, and it stimulates or kills bacteria, which is a big cause of a lot of stomach ulcers. So in a sense, cayenne could be in the top 10. I guess I'm thinking in terms of like another herb I would choose in the top 10 would be something that's antimicrobial, antifungal, maybe antiparasitic for amoebas like Giardia or Montezuma's Revenge or a protozoa that gets into your gut. And I'm thinking black walnut. Because I've seen black walnut in California. I'm not sure how far black walnut grows east. Anybody know? Who lives?
Pennsylvania.
I know it grows as far as Minnesota. It's going to grow in North Florida. So black walnut, is the availability is fairly predominant across the United States. Black walnut, you would want to use the leaf, and you'd want to use maybe the branches. Some people use the green hulls. They're real strong, and they're powerful. Whether you use the green hulls, the leaf, or the branches, black walnut is a very powerful anti-amoebic herb. It's also very good for being an antifungal. This still means it's really good for candida, candidiasis, yeast infections. And so it's very versatile. You can use black walnut topically to kill funguses, to help treat wounds that are infected. You can use black walnut internally in small amounts, maybe 10 to 30 drops of the extract or a couple times a day, or you can use black walnut tea to treat Giardia, amoebic dysentery. Giardia is a big killer. You know, if you were patriots living up in the mountain drinking out of spring water, you probably end up with Giardia. probably end up with, you know, dysentery and, you know.
I just want to make a point that no water is safe in the country anymore. So it used to be part of the bathroom, water stream, preferably just moved out the stream from the waterfall and counted it be good to drink, but not anymore. And the Army is especially surveilling the cattle country in the places where the process was raised as a year ago.
Bill's absolutely right. No water in America, springs, lakes, springs, you know, maybe just kind of closed over and coming right out of the rocks out of a little pipe. And, you know, I mean, even the pipe could become infected. You know, and you can pick, giardia up and not ever drink water. You can get it in your fingernails and eat your sandwich and transfer the egg casings, the cysts, right into your system and never drink any water. It's just you kind of didn't wash your hands and were along the stream bank picking plants or playing, you know, fishing and never even drunk the water and infected yourself with giardia. So you might keep that in mind. And I think it's an important thing, having an anti-protozoa type of plant on hand, because number one, even if you never get giardia, especially if you're a woman or even a man and you have to take large amounts of antibiotics for some reason, you run the risk of getting a yeast infection, a topical or a vaginal or an anal or a thrush around the mouth type of yeast infection. That's what candida is. It's a yeast. It often surfaces if you go on sugar binges or drink too much coffee or go through too much stress. But most candidiasis problems or yeast infections surface because of antibiotic use. Candida is Candida albicans. Candida is the genus, albicans is the species. It's a natural occurring fungus in the human body. It aids in digestion. And it lives in the intestinal tract, lives in the mucous membranes. Children who get candida is called thrush around the mouth, kind of an itchy, flaky yeast infection. Men can get it, and sometimes it's called jock itch. Women get it, and it's called vaginal yeast infection. And it's often triggered because you stress the body out through the use of antibiotics, sugar, coffee, etc. And black walnut is a very powerful anti-candida herb. So I mean, that alone makes it very valuable, because many millions of folks are infected through yeast infections and have it as a major problem.
Mike, when you say black walnut, you're talking about
that great black walnut shell. It's probably optimum. The use of black walnut, what part do you use, would be a little bit of the leaf, a little bit of the fresh young branch tips, and maybe even a couple of the green hulls, kind of the whole end part. It may, you know, part of an end branch of black walnut, of a black walnut tree, there'll be some leaves, there'll be some young branches, there may be one or two green hulls. You can incorporate all of that, chopped up, dried for tea, or chopped up and done as a fresh plant extract, 1 to 2. You can put it in a little vodka, like I described outside, and make it, you know, fresh plant extract.
So the depth is green.
You want the green hull. The inside, no. Yeah, there's kind of the inner meat is really, I've never seen that used. I've never used that myself. It's kind of classic with the green hull of the nut, it would be, is what people would prefer.
It'll really stain when you wear that.
True. Very, you know, black walnut stains very, very significantly. So, yeah, your hands will get totally stained, your clothes. You might want to keep that in mind.
How about that with the,
can you use the hulls after they dry up, draft? Yeah, you might want to chop them up into fairly manageable sized pieces while they're green. So, because when they dry, they get really hard, and if you try to throw them in a blender or try to cut them up, it might be more difficult. So, when you harvest, say, the black walnut branches, you know, a big branch of black walnut, you might want to cut it up in segments. It's not that you pulverize it down, but just cut the cut the hull in half and maybe in quarters so that it's manageable. You know, get the middle part, get the seed out of there, and scrape off the green hull in smaller pieces. It's a strong plant. It doesn't lose much of its medicine upon drying, so you don't have to worry about chopping it up too small. It's a powerful plant. You know, it doesn't lose the majority of its medicinal properties upon drying for years and years. And it's a fungal infections. I mean, if you've got something you brought back from Nam or from Panama or from the jungles, a fungal infection that occurs occasionally due to stress or some dietary trigger mechanism, and you have it on your feet or your legs or in your crotch, and it's like a fungus that you've had for 10, 20 years, sometimes black walnut has been very beneficial for some of those non-funguses that people brought back who've had some success. Sometimes taking tea tree oil and black walnut extract and combining the two together actually is very effective for some of those really stubborn funguses, those jungle funguses. So in general, any fungus is a good approach for most funguses. And believe it or not, having a good antifungal is really important because there's hardly any pharmaceutical drugs out there that are good effective antifungals. As some of you guys know, if you brought funguses back, you had them with you for a long time, and that you tried stuff, it's worked, but, you know, even allopathic medicine admits that they just don't have great antifungals available. So, and herbs can be powerful, powerful antifungals. Black walnut being one. So you use it as an antifungal, anti-candida. You can use it topically to treat wounds. It'll stain a little bit, but it's anti-staph, so it's really good for possible staph prone wounds, or if staph infection is running around, you know, the black walnut could be good to paint on the wound. It'll stain your skin a little bit, but that's much better than getting a staph infection. So it's good to have an anti-amoebic, anti-protozoa herb, and I think black walnut, I have some from, you know, in the Southwest that are they're real powerful, even a little bit more powerful than black walnut, but they're only found in the Southwest. And I was thinking earlier that black walnut could be in the top 10 list because it's accessible and it's a strong anti-protozoa type plant. You also need in the top 10 list, you need a basic immunostimulant. You need something that stimulates the immune system to produce extra white blood cells so you can go out and scavenge waste more effectively. And I think a lot of you know this plant, and it is accessible because you can either find it, grow it, or buy it right now. And you can grow it from California all the way up into New England, Canada, and it's in Central Florida. It's called purple coneflower, also known as echinacea. Echinacea, echinacea. That's the genus, and there are different species. There's angustifolia, purpurea, some people say. It doesn't matter. There's like three major species, pallida, purpurea, and angustifolia. Some people say that angustifolia is the strongest of the three species. Purpurea would be easier to grow. It's a real broadleaf one. It's purple coneflower, prairie coneflower, big purple sunflower type of flower found in gardens, ornamental gardens, and medicinal plant gardens throughout the world now. It is one of the most researched immunostimulants on the face of the earth. In Germany alone, there's over 200 scientific papers on its immune-stimulating ability. And this is one country that's the Germans are very effective in plant monographs, and very good at plant research and developing phytotherapy. They're also the ones really vying to control the entire world commerce of medicinal plants, too, through the the Codex Alimentarius. I kind of got swept away for a little while. It's still there. You know, the agenda is to control herbal medicines, patent them, and eliminate your accessibility to them by making them prescription oriented and making them phytotherapies instead of, you know, to take your self-sufficiency and your relationship away. You know, it's because it's, for them, it's mega millions, billions of dollars that you're able to own and control it. But echinacea, a great accessible immunostimulant. A lot of you might use it, a lot of you probably tried it. It's great for colds, it's great for flus, it's great for viruses, sinus infections. It stimulates the immune system to just push a little harder. And one of the active, to give you an idea how a plant may be an immunostimulant, just if you're curious, Echinacea contains a chemical compound called echinacean. Echinacean, when you drink this tea or take the extract, when you drink echinacea tea, that chemical constituent goes into the body and mimics the virus. It antagonizes your body as a viral entity. It's not a viral, it's a chemical compound called echinacean, but your body thinks it's a virus. So it quickly cranks out a bunch of white blood cells to go out and meet this intruder at the gate. And when these white blood cells get out there, they're like, what the hell's going on? This is a chemical compound. This is not a virus. So they've already been made, they've already been stimulated and proliferated. Echinacean, the chemical constituent, is of no consequence. But the white blood cells have been encouraged to be produced. So now they turn around and they actually go after the virus that's been lingering in your body. And it does it very, very well. The downside of using echinacea for a long period of time, or trying to use echinacea as a preventative to catch a cold or a flu, is your body is brilliant. And it'll eventually stop responding to the intruder because it'll be like, the immune system has memory capability. That's how you naturally immunize yourself. You catch a virus, you catch a bacteria, and your body builds a library on this encounter. And next time it knows how to respond quicker and builds up a response program, so that particular virus is really never of a major consequence again. It's a natural immunization process that the body is innately given, it's just that's what the immune system does. The memory cells are responsible for remembering the encounters with foreign bodies. And so eventually you stop getting the benefits of echinacea. You'll still get some, but you won't get that crisp, powerful. But I don't know if you've ever tried some of these immunostimulants or some of the things like echinacea. But when you get sick, you have a window of opportunity. You know what I mean? It's like you often say to yourself, I'm coming down with a cold. I feel achy. That's the perfect time to take a big glass of water, perfect time to take some echinacea and some ginger tea. It's the window of opportunity of approaching your virus or your bacteria. And you innately know this. You say to yourself, everyone's catching a cold, and it's like, I feel achy, oh my God. There's the windows of opportunity are like acknowledgeable. And all you have to do is learn to recognize them and say, hey, that's the time to do the immunostimulant. Because you take it and you bring your immune system up and you push the illness right out of the body. And that's the benefit of using echinacea. It's safe, it's a simple one, it's accessible, it's growable, it's harvestable in the wild. Some areas it's a little bit, some areas it's more endangered or stressed out because it's so popular, but you can grow it, and there's a lot of it being grown throughout the United States, and it's probably one to consider as if you're, there's money, there's livelihoods to be made. For some of you who may have farms in the Ozarks or Missouri or Pennsylvania and have ever thought about growing herbs for a living, it's a big business, and there's always room. I mean, there's people that make $200,000 on 5 acres of herbal medicines, lavender, or some really exotic specialty things. But I mean, there are possibilities of making a livelihood by growing something like echinacea for those who have the right soil, the right conditions. Another aspect of this whole thing, not just is it information to save you money and give you self-sufficiency in relation back to nature, but believe it or not, herbal medicine could, for some of you, could give you a livelihood and even a greater percentage of self-sufficiency if that's what you want to do.
Are these seeds for the herbs, are they open pollinated, non-hybrid seeds?
Absolutely. I mean, there's some that might be patented and hybrided now, but they're not really, not very, very few, like yarrow. Yarrow in the wild is mostly white flowers, but in the garden you find yellow, you find pink, and some of the yarrow flowers are now owned and patented and hybrided. But I would never consider using them a medicine when I have all the wild stuff and all the, you know, the non-hybrid stuff that I could grow. It might still be a good medicine, but most herbal medicines are non-hybrid, open-pollinated plants. So Echinacea makes it in the top 10.
If you want to grow herbs, and I do grow a lot, but if you have unlimited space, who knows? Would it be better to just let them grow in the wild or to actually cultivate a garden of herbs?
Good concept of permaculture. Your question is it better to grow herbs or to let them grow wild? And actually the answer in this cultivation is to do both. Absolutely. If you have a piece of land that has a hillside, some trees, a little creek, some shaded areas, some open areas, some of it are going to be more favorable to planting. I mean, I'm a wild crafter. I go into nature, go into the wild, and I prefer to steward, harvest properly, plant seeds in the wild, you know. The plants that are growing just help to encourage them. And it's an age old, I mean, it's been happening for, you know, thousands of years and very few herbalists really grow their own plants because they prefer wild harvesting.
And that's it for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed this broadcast. And more than that, I hope you really learned something. Good night, and God bless each and every single one of you. You've been listening to The Hour of the Tongue. I'm William Cooper. This is 101.1 FM Eager, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM Eager is your nonprofit community service radio station. We now return you to all oldies most of the time.
30,441, take one. important word. That's all I got. They say